I asked you to think about some of the stories that you've covered that have made an impression on you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so interested in what you had to say about the story that involves our Virginia's most illustrious historical figure, Mr. Plecker.
Oh, my word.
Can you lay the background for that story?
Okay, well, Mr. Plecker was the head of the State Bureau of Vital Statistics. A terrific bureaucratic job that you would think, this is not going to get anybody in trouble. He's keeping track of births and deaths and marriages.
And when was this?
This was around just after the turn of the century.
Okay.
And Mr. Plecker took that job and turned it into something one would associate more with Germany under Hitler than anything in America. And he decided that the problem, and he wasn't alone, there was a movement, kind of a worldwide movement that came out of a twisted version, a twisted reading of Darwin, that you could improve the human race by simply eliminating people who you thought were bringing the human race down. And in Mr. Plecker's case, it was half-breeds, mostly, that he thought were the cause of the world's troubles. And if he could just get rid of quadroons, octoroons, macaroons, you name it, anybody who wasn't lily white or absolutely black, who were, I guess, supposed to work for the lily whites, the Virginia would just be, and actually he extended on beyond Virginia, he thought the country would be terrific. So he targeted some populations in Virginia and decided he was going to clean them up by attrition. If you don't let them marry, then, well, they're certainly not going to have children if they're not married. And so they'll just kind of die off because they won't have any kids. So he got to be insane, insanely bureaucratic and obsessed with going through marriage licenses and deciding who should have them and who shouldn't. And he sent things out to all the magistrates who issued marriage licenses. You can't let white people marry anybody but white people, or black people marry anybody but black people, and you can't let octoroons, quadroons, macaroons, and part Indians marry anybody. One of the areas he targeted was in Rockbridge County, spilling over into Amherst. It was Irish Creek is the part of the county. And the Irish Creek people have, you know, what their ultimate ancestry is. Who knows? Who knows what anybody's ultimate ancestry is? But Mr. Plecker thought they were all half-breeds, to use his word. Well, one of his better words for him. And so there was a couple in Irish Creek who wanted to get married. And after getting a memo from Plecker, the circuit court clerk denied them their marriage license.
What was the pollutant, according to Mr. Plecker? Were they Native Americans?
Yes.
Or do we care?
One of them was, as far as Plecker was concerned, white. And the other one was, he thought, a quadroon or a macaroon. They said they were part Native Americans, and they had documents going back to the War of 1812 showing that, and they had these elaborate family trees, and so these people decided to appeal the denial of the marriage license, and they did so. And I knew about that years and years ago, but it took forever to find the actual case file, which, as it turns out, was down in Richmond, stashed in a place where maybe it should have been stashed, but After years and years, it just kind of hit me, maybe it's in Richmond. And I called the state library and asked if they had it in the judgments, which were these pile of old court cases about all sorts of things. And they did have it, and they were kind enough to send me everything out of the file that they had about Mr. Plecker and his dealings in Rockbridge County.
Mm.
And those included, because Plecker thought about appealing this case, it included a full transcript of the trial.
Where did the trial take place?
It took place in the Rockbridge County Courthouse. And Plecker himself came to town with a piano player who he traveled with. Now, Mr. Plecker was married, but he's most of the time he went around the state with his piano player, who would play little recitals for people, garden clubs and nice little civic organizations, while Plecker was trying to absolutely exterminate classes of human beings. The piano player would be playing Chopin and Mozart and sort of thrilling the town high society. Go figure. Anyway, this family was so well prepared and they had such good lawyers that they won the case. And the judge, a man by the name of Holt, in this what could only be called an unbelievably courageous decision, he not only ordered the clerk to grant him a marriage license, but he tore into Virginia's eugenics laws.
Wow.
He said, these are just silly. Under these laws, you know, a Hungarian prince couldn't marry a white woman in America. And where do these big classes of Europeans fall? They're not really white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Where do Italians fall? Where do Irish people fall? And so afterwards, Mr. Plecker, with that decision, what he did was simply ignore it and kept on his merry way for years and years and years to come. Hitler wound up citing Virginia's eugenics laws as a fine model for how to reorganize the world. This couple, oddly enough, after being married, they wound up getting divorced years later, and they moved out of Irish Creek. But a lot of the families up there had felt for years. I mean, they remembered this.
Yeah.
You know, the collective memory goes back long enough. And, you know, and they felt that they had been wronged. And I hadn't had a lot of calls from people up there saying, Doug, I wish you'd write about this. In fact, nobody had ever called me. But when I found it and started printing just this transcript.
How did you find it? Why this particular story?
Originally, I found it. It seems to me that I was going through some old newspapers. I mean, this was 15 years ago when I first found it, and saw a little mention of the trial. They didn't print much of anything about it, but there was a little mention of Plecker coming to town with the piano player, and that he was going to be a star witness in this trial. And then there was a side little, there was more, as I remember, about the piano recital than there was about the trial. But it just kind of nagged at me, and I thought there's got to be something out there somewhere about this. And I guess I've learned over the years, patience is not a virtue that I was born with, but I've learned that with a lot of things, you know, you just need to be a little patient and wait, and when the right time is, things kind of will pop up. And so anyway, after I started printing these stories, all these people from up on Irish Creek and these descendants of these families who had been targeted started calling up and coming into my office and just thanking me for it. There was one man who was furious about it, who just thought I shouldn't have brought it up again and this was all too painful and blah, 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 blah. But for the most part, there were people who were extremely supportive of it and armed with this information that came from these transcripts about family trees and kinships. Some of these people applied to become members of the Monacan Indian tribe, and the Monacans had been a little leery about some of these folks before, saying, well, wait a minute now, we're not sure, and how do you prove this? And all of a sudden they had the evidence they needed. You know, it was something they had been trying to be vindicated for years and years and years about it. And just having that story in print made them feel vindicated and made them feel like they finally got some justice in this world or the families had.
I was interested in what you said when you emailed me about this story. You said, I didn't write it well. What does that mean? What is a journalist?
Well, I don't view myself as a terribly good writer, and there are always things that I wish I could have done better or done differently, and especially with some of the historical things I've done over the years. I feel like, you know, I kind of hope transcripts will speak for themselves and that people will put things together and figure things out. And sometimes I forget that, you know, readers need a guide. And it's always good to let them know, you know, this is what you're going to be seeing, and this is how to follow it, and here's who the cast of characters are. And sometimes I just get so excited about finding the transcript. I go, yippee, and I don't need to explain this. It all speaks
just
for itself.
Splat it down on the page.
Yeah, just throw it out there, and all people will know this. Later I realize, you know, hindsight's 20/20, and I go, no, I should have spelled this out differently. There's another one that I got way too excited about it and started printing all this stuff as I was finding it, and I didn't even know how it was going to turn out before I started writing it. And that was this piece, I think I sent you a little something about this old slave trial that happened in Rockbridge County. I got just so excited finding this information that I got, oh boy, I found this, and I'll just hurl it on the page here.
Now go into a little background on this.
Okay,
please.
These were, well, it was not really folks from Rockbridge County, but in the Rockbridge County Courthouse, and I love rooting around in old papers. I started when I was a little kid, and my family were pack rats, and they saved everything. And my granddaddy had them all in all these trunks up in his chicken house. And when I was a little boy, I'd go up and open up a trunk and just start reading and find all these wonderful, scandalous things about my own family. And it was, and I've never quite gotten over that. It's just fun reading old stuff. And so I like to go into the courthouse and just kind of start opening up old order books and things that nobody's cracked open in a few years. And one day I was in there waiting for a trial. And it was an embezzlement trial, I think. And I went down and just opened up a book that I really hadn't looked at before. It's this huge ledger book. And most of it was blank. But near the front of it was a bit of a transcript. And it was from the early 1800s, and what it was testimony that had been objected to in a trial. I just started reading it, and I got fascinated. The trial was called Eunice versus Charlton. Eunice spelled U-N-I-S. And from reading the little that's in Rockbridge County about it, it was a couple of slaves down in Montgomery County who sued for their freedom.
Back in the early 1800s?
In the early 1800s. Wow. And they did after their owner drank a big glass of buttermilk one day and fell over dead. And why they waited for him to fall over dead, I have no idea.
Buttermilk, not bourbon.
Buttermilk.
Buttermilk. Okay, I just want to be clear.
And I have never had a drop of buttermilk since I heard that. But anyway, there wasn't much about it in Rockbridge County, but there was enough to wet my whistle. And I went down to the Montgomery County Courthouse and found, actually, the file for this case. A lot of the file was missing. It vanished back as the trial was actually happening. There were several trials. And you can imagine taking these files around by horseback, 50 miles here and 100 miles there, and you know, in the rain and something falls into a creek and, you know, just what happened to a lot of it, nobody knows. And before I started spending too much time with it, I called around and to some historians I know and looked around on the internet, and really nothing had been written about this, which astonished me.
Yes.
Actually, the case was cited in some other things, but it didn't have anything to do with slavery. It had to do with the admissibility of depositions in court, which wasn't very helpful. So I went down to Montgomery County and started reading this file. And then when I was reading it, what their claim was that Eunice had been basically stolen, that she was a free woman up in New England, in Connecticut, and in Massachusetts, and that she and her two children were stolen and sold to a man from here, from Montgomery County, and hauled down to Virginia. And they had been free up there, and so their whole being enslaved was illegal. That was the long and short of the case. Well, as it dragged on over the decades, the first trial was a hung jury.
Over the decades?
Yes.
And how did an enslaved person ever
wind up in court?
Yes.
Well, it's a funny thing. When old man Charlton, he wasn't that old, when he fell over dead
of his buttermilk.
From his buttermilk. The two daughters who had been grabbed along with mom, And Mom, I'm not sure. It's not clear from the record if she was still alive or if she just didn't want anything to do with it or what happened to her, I don't know. But the two children, as soon as the old man fell over dead, they went to a magistrate and basically swore out a warrant. And the magistrate was obviously sympathetic. I don't know if he didn't like the Charlton family. I'm not sure why he did what he did.
And this was in Rockbridge?
No, this was in Montgomery.
Montgomery, I'm sorry.
And so these children said, Eunice was one of the children. Actually, Flora was the mom. Eunice made her claim. The magistrate swore out a warrant. And Charlton's heirs didn't show up. They just blew it off. Well, because they blew it off, the magistrate said, okay, you're free. So all of a sudden, they were free women and free people who had status to get it into court. And some of the wrangling isn't quite clear to me over, who appealed to get it into court. My guess is the Charlton's heirs. But there it was. The battle was off and running.
So the lawsuit was brought against them as to sort of upend this freedom that they'd been granted?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, it started as an appeal, and over the years it changed from Eunice versus Charlton to Charlton versus Eunice, and it went back and forth. But what originally triggered it was the magistrate and the executors just not showing up, and so the magistrate said, well, this is a default. You win. Well, the first trial was a hung jury. The second one was a hung jury. Then it was moved to, I forget where it went first. It wound up going to Giles County and Roanoke County, and there were hung juries everywhere. So it wound up in Rockbridge. They were just running out of places to move it. And the Rockbridge County jury set him free. They said, you're absolutely right. You win. Well, needless to say, the family appealed. The state Supreme Court said, no, get back to the cotton fields. Just stop this freedom stuff. You're not free. So there was another trial in Montgomery County, and by that time, Nat Turner's Rebellion had happened. The Virginia Fugitive Slave Laws had happened. People had gotten a little nervous about abolitionists. And so the final trial in Montgomery, the executors won. The slaves appealed, and the state Supreme Court basically said, you again? No. But the whole thing, because it started in New England with this kidnapping, it wound up being kind of a cause in New England. Mm-hmm. And some of the biggest, best attorneys in New England got involved in it for free. There was one who wound up on the Connecticut Supreme Court, who actually wrote a little bit about it. But anyway, they were from Farmington, Connecticut, and Southwick, Massachusetts, and these little towns that I grew up near.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd see some of these names of people who were giving depositions, these old men and women who remembered these people when they were free and remember going to their wedding and on and on. They were names of, like, children I went to school with. You know, they were people my grandfather knew. And it was just so weird feeling this kind of genetic pull into this case. And sadly, I kind of ran out of time and wits to chase down more about it. I'm sure there's a lot more that can be found somewhere about it. I just don't know where.
But you ran several articles about it?
Well, yeah, I ran five, and basically I printed everything I could find in the courthouses.
The transcripts?
Yes.
And what was the reaction of Rockbridge County?
Well, people were either fascinated with it or they were bored with it. Mm-hmm. I heard some people say it would be a terrific movie and I really ought to turn it into a book, and I heard some people saying, what are you printing that nonsense for? It happened a long time ago, and it wasn't really Rockbridge County people. But what I really, really feel bad about is, that I was just kind of throwing this stuff in the papers I was finding it instead of being patient and waiting until I found everything that I could find and then sitting down, reading it all, being careful, organizing it, and giving people a guide to go through this stuff and to be helpful to the readers. And it's really important as a writer to be helpful to readers. And it's why I say I'm not a very good writer, because sometimes I don't do that.
Is the Rockbridge Advocate basically the lead stories, not the, you know, general, not the coverage of activities of daily living and thing, but the lead stories, the ones that you pick to cover, are those the just generally the ones that speak to you as a person, that pique your interest for some?
Well, I'm kind of curious, and so almost everything piques my interest. You have to, it's one of the things, if you're a journalist or even trying, even thinking about being a journalist, if you're not incredibly curious, you should forget about it, unless you want to be a TV weather person and look nice and get your hair blow dried every day. So all these things that I write about, I'm write about them because I'm just curious how the world works, and I'm curious how our county works, and I'm curious, you know, about everything.
I do know.
But the lead story, you know, it goes on the cover. I sit, you know, I work and work and work every month, and there's usually more stories than I can possibly have either time to finish or room to fit in the paper. But I'll write three or four, you know, stories that I think are interesting. They're interesting to me, and I hope they'll be interesting to other people. And then I sit down and go, all right, what's going to sell the most papers? Because that's what, you know, the front page only has one story. And people come up sometimes and they say, well, you just printed that because you want to sell newspapers. And I can only say, let's see, I'm supposed to not sell newspapers? That's a business plan. So what goes on the front is the one I think that'll sell the most, and I try and think of a snappy headline for it, and there it is.
Have you ever been sued?
Yes.
Over? Successfully?
No.
Okay.
It was funny. It was a man by the name of Melvin Martin. Now, I wrote a story about Melvin's, one of his brothers went on trial for stabbing one of his other brothers. And Melvin was nowhere around, but he figured into all of this. Melvin had gotten in a lot of trouble, and he had killed at least one person, maybe two or three, it all depended. But he was a fairly scary human being. And
is he still with us?
No.
Okay.
He's gone to his demise. But at this trial of the brother, and the headline for the story was Martin Boys Take a Stab at Brotherly Love, because after one of them stabbed the other one, he says, what'd you do that for? He went, because I love you, brother. Anyway, Melvin, the police were all around the courthouse thinking Melvin was going to show up and literally shoot the place up. And so a lot of the story really was whether Melvin would come out of hiding or not. And I think I quoted the police chief in Buena Vista saying that Melvin was a little crazy. And Melvin, who was in federal prison when he got a hold of the story, filed a suit.
He took exception to this.
He took great exception to this. And he said, as a licensed journalist, I should know better. And
what is a licensed journalist?
I don't know. I don't have one.
I don't either.
Do you?
No. We'll have to look into this.
Well,
curious minds.
But
that
it was
kind—it
was kind of scary because at the end of the lawsuit, it said, "I only wish I could deliver this lawsuit personally to Mr. Harwood at the end of a baseball bat." Well, when I got a copy of it, the judge. Turk, I believe, had thrown the thing out, and the only way I found out about the suit was I got a copy of it with an order dismissing it. So that was the only time I ever got sued.
But you've ever been sued?
Yes. But a lot of times people call up and they threaten to, and you know, I try to be careful, and I mean, people could sue anybody for anything, so I suppose one day somebody might.
You were raised up in Massachusetts on a farm. How'd you end up at Washington and Lee?
Well, I had a history teacher. The school I went to didn't have guidance counselors. And If they had, they probably would have sent me off to, you know, apple picking school or something. But I had a history teacher, and I was kind of floundering around looking where to go to college. And he said, look, you ought to apply to Washington Lee. And I said, why? And he said, well, you like history, and it's old, and it's run down, and Lexington is an old, run down southern town, and it's in the prettiest place in the world with a lot of dirt roads, and you'd like it down there. And I went, okay. And so I applied, and I got in, and it seemed conservative enough for my parents to agree to bankroll it. And so, sight unseen, a couple days before class, I drove into Lexington, and there it was.
And there it was, and here you still are. You said it was conservative enough for your parents. I'm looking at you, sitting across from me, and you don't look conservative to me. Well, were your parents conservative? And are you conservative?
Well, my mother once got so excited about Richard Nixon coming to town that she ran after the train that he was on trying to get his autograph and hurt herself falling down. And my father was... conservative would be an understatement. He was, he was not a very pleasant man. Actually, he was a con man was what he was, but he was a very an overly conservative con man. He was a reactionary who basically didn't like anybody or anything, and well, he and I didn't get along very well, but he was extraordinarily conservative.
What do you like?
I like pretty much everything, and I don't think of myself as being a liberal or a conservative or in anything. I think of myself as a human being,
a curious human being,
and you know, and people try to peg you as you know, you if you write something and somebody who's conservative doesn't like it, they'll go, oh, that's just a bunch of liberal trash. And if someone who's liberal doesn't like it, they'll go, oh, what are you, just some right-wing kook? And I managed to hear about equal criticism from all sides of the political spectrum, and so I figure it's about, at least the paper's kind of in the middle somewhere.
I want to go back to
Aurora Borealis
Linksweiler, who famously said, he's all right, he just doesn't remember. If you ain't from here, you ain't from here. And I'm assuming she was from Rockbridge County.
Oh, yeah, Linksweiler is one of those fine old rock... A friend of mine once composed a Gregorian chant of Rockbridge County names. And Linksweiler was right up there with
right
Hofstetter and Hottinger and Hartbarger.
All right. With Aurora Borealis comment in mind, does Rockbridge County feel like home to you?
Now, that's a funny question.
And you have to think about it.
Well, I do, I suppose, for one reason. You know, it's... When my mother died, I got a bunch of old photographs she had, and there's one of me standing at down at my what had been my great grandfather's farm out in a field, and I remember that day, and it was very strange seeing that picture. I was, I suppose, about 9 years old, and it was the day when it occurred to me that I wasn't quite sure that I belonged on this planet. And this is kind of a funny place, and maybe I wonder what I'm doing here. And I suppose every 9-year-old has that feeling, or every 10-year-old has that feeling of, you know, do I really belong here or not? And I'm not sure I could ever really answer that question. You know, what was this? But Rockbridge County is as close to home as, you know, as I've ever had and as close as I'm going to get. You know, but that's how I can answer that. So it does feel like I'm perfectly comfortable there. I know a lot of people. It's, you know, and it certainly is the most wonderful place I know of on the earth.
What have I not asked you that I should?
Well, I don't know about should.
That you'd like to talk about. What have I missed? Anything. It can be nothing.
Well,
I just always like to ask because these are very loosey-goosey interviews.
Well, you know, you didn't ask me about playing drums in a polka band.
Please lay on, Duff.
Well, when I was a little boy, when I was in elementary school, actually, there were too many trombone players, and there were too many trumpet players, and there were too many violin players, and this elementary school teacher said, "Doug, you're going to be a drummer," and I went, "Cool." And so I started taking drum lessons, as it turns out, from this wonderful, wonderful teacher who was an old man with a big drum shop with these creaky wooden floors and old drums piled up everywhere. And he was very meticulous, wore this nice suit and a tie every day. And he had been a vaudeville drummer with all of these big bands in vaudeville days. And he smoked these huge cigars. And he'd go back into his studio and it was just these clouds of smoke. But anyway, after a couple of years, he landed me a job in a polka band. I think he thought everybody should play in a polka band at some point in their lives. And so I did. And there was this unbelievable trumpet player in this band who we played at a place called Pilsudski Hall in Chicopee, Massachusetts. And we played a couple nights a week. And by the end of the night, the trumpet player would literally be hanging from a sewer pipe over the stage with his shirt off, playing trumpet solos. And the crowd would go wild and say, "Play another version of Who Stole the Kishka?" And we'd play Who Stole the Kishka for the 10th time of the night. And everybody in the band, except for me and the trumpet player, they were these old men. But it was huge fun. And we played all these weddings there that would usually end with these fights. These gigantic fights, and chairs would start flying, bottles would start flying. It was like a scene out of the Blues Brothers. And somebody would come up and say, "Stop the music, stop the music." And we'd get up our instruments and be running out the back door when the police were running in the front door. And it was just a real experience in learning about human beings and watching human beings. And it was straight out of a Flemish painting or something.
And I'm sure it prepared you well for starting and maintaining the Rockbridge Advocate. Didn't
it prepared me for trying to be a little thick-skinned about critics. I mean, if they didn't like the music up at the Pilsudski Hall, they made it real clear they'd kick a hole in the drum or grab the trumpet and smash it. So you learned to kind of be, I suppose you didn't like that.
Doug Harwood, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, that's going to be the easiest edit I've ever done. I'm going to go in and save your sound file. Have you got time for lunch?
Well, of course I do.
Because
people got to eat.
People got to eat. If you need the men's room, it's out that door and straight through the double door.
So what happens with this thing now?